David Ware, Real 2. We were talking about your time working for the Forestry Commission in Keswick. Now, you worked right through the winter. What were winter conditions? What was it like in the Keswick area in the working hours?
Well, it was Bassenthwaite, and we worked above Bassenthwaite, which was the lake outside Keswick. And it was very wet during October and November, but then December and January and February were lovely months. When it was beautiful, it was beautiful. I mean, clear blue skies, and it was very cold. And you had to work hard to keep warm. And because a lot of it was on piecework, the intensity of the work was pretty great. Although we were just volunteers, we got paid, but they basically were looked upon as junior volunteers. Because the group of I was with all were joined Air Force or Fleet Air Arm and waiting to go to have their call up for training. So that was, quite a lot of fun.
Do you think it toughened you up and got you ready for...
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not sure really for war, but because it toughened you up. I mean, if you go climbing up on the back of a horse in January up above Bassenthwaite and looking down at the lake and across to Skiddaw, and, you know, it's lovely.
Were you only doing wood for pit props, or was it for other things as well?
Only for pit props. Yeah, I didn't think anything else. No pit props. They were all going pit props because then they were stacked into their various lengths. They're 5 foot, 4 foot. We did various lengths. I mean, a tree. You had one long tree like that. The first cut off might be 6 feet, and the next one might be 4 feet, and the last one 2 feet. And
how wide was it the best?
I don't think width was. We were into width. The trees we were given were already pruned to be cut to pit props.
Did you square them off?
No. Nope.
So they were just cut?
Cut. They were all round, like a big log. You still see them occasionally. I don't know what they're using them for, because they don't use them for mines anymore. But then, of course, I think after later on, I mean, not from my point of view, later on historically, they became steel and wasn't wooden.
Now, in, 17th of May 1941, you went to the 5th ITW at Torquay. Now, ITW would stand
Initial
for...
Initial Training Wing.
And when you arrived, you were there as a leading aircraftman from the...
No, AC-2.
AC-2, right, that's wrong, yes, on the 4th...
Aircraftsman too, nothing lower.
And could you tell me what your reception was like, you know, when you arrived?
Well, we went to Torquay, and I had to go by train from Keswick to London, and it was a week after the biggest raid on London. And therefore, the parents, father didn't want me to stay a night in London. So we went on the night train, I went on the night train, to Paddington, and then got a train to Torquay, and I arrived at Torquay on an afternoon, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, to be met by a very tall sergeant with a stick, and all these youngsters climbing off the train were people who were going to be trained as pilots or navigators. And we went to Babbicombe is next door to Torquay, and all the hotels had been taken over, and we were bunked down into must be 10 or 15 hotels. And then we started our medical training, our medical uniform outfitting, having needles pressed into you and fainting like mad.
Did you faint?
No, I didn't. I felt dozy. But some guys, and one guy I remember sort of laughing at us because we called us chickens, and then in the afternoon we were doing a drill parade, and he just suddenly flopped down. He just fell. So we rather laughed at that and said, you must take care not to... But we're drilling...
Did the vaccination have much effect on you once you'd had it? Because sometimes there's a reaction, isn't there, on the arm and...
Yeah. Well, mine was immediate. I felt pretty dozy and dizzy, and they put me onto a couch, and about 5 minutes I was okay again.
And the other thing was kitting out. What do you remember? What you were kitted out with?
Uniform.
Which parts of the uniform?
Everything. I mean, all our clothes were removed and put into a bag and technically sent home. I think we were shirts. There were underwear. There were shirts. two pairs of trousers, two jackets, no battle dress at that stage, because there weren't any battle dresses, and a gas mask, which is most important, and a hat, a forage cap, I think they call them, and a great coat, and I don't think we had a raincoat, no, just a great coat.
Did your uniform fit?
Oh yes. They were very good, they were very organised. Highly organised, I thought.
Now, did you stay in these billets in Babbacombe?
Yep.
What can you describe what the hotel billets were like as billets?
Oh, it was beautiful. I had a lovely room with shared with two others, or four of us. And it looked right out across the ocean, and it was beautiful. And we ate in a central canteen, so we did only billeted there. It was a hotel. They'd just literally taken over, and I think the hotel provided all the linen and everything like that.
So the civilian hotel owners were still there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It hadn't been totally taken over by the Army, by the Air Force.
I would say it had been totally, because I don't think there was any business for them otherwise, because I don't think people came down to talk here.
Now, if we sort of look at a typical day's training, that'll pick up a lot of the sort of training you did. And there is no such thing as a typical day that you can remember from 50 years ago, but it perhaps let us look at what the sort of things you did. By what time would your day start?
Well, at 8 o'clock on the button, and it would be drill.
How did you take to drill? You'd done drill before, but how did you take to it?
It was very competitive because they put you into squads, and the idea was squad to compete against each other. So the sergeants used to march you up and down until you were very tired. And then I think we did a certain amount of classroom work too.
What sort of classroom work?
Just an introduction to aviation generally. I think I'm not quite sure we did navigation. Certainly we didn't. I'm not quite sure how much we are talking about Babbacombe as opposed to Torquay. We moved from Babbacombe down to Torquay to do our initial training wing. Babbacombe was just where you were kitted out and medicated.
I see, yes.
And what you're asking me, what happened when we got down there? We went down the hill to another lovely hotel we'd been visited not so long ago, and there we were billeted. And there we started our air training, navigation, radio, Morse, everything.
Well, let's take those things one by one. Navigation.
Right.
What was it to learn and how did you learn it?
Well, it was DR navigation in those days.
DR meaning?
Dead reckoning. So it was pretty basic, pretty simple stuff.
What's the principle behind it then? And how did you? Because you weren't so hot at math, you seem to imply when we were talking about education.
It didn't seem to apply too much. I don't think the math mattered too much. It was very basic stuff, and measuring out. In fact, it was rather fun because a lot of it was practical work. You're given a map and you drew a line, and then took a course and took a wind vector and basically worked out the ground speed, and you were given the airspeed and things like that. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So you'd work out how that would affect, the things like the wind speed would affect where you'd drift to.
Correct. I think the aim was navigation to teach you about ground speed and wind speed, but then the other second aspect was the weather aspect, training for weather, MET. Classes, which were most interesting.
Tell me about those.
Well, I mean, meteorology in flying was very basic, part of the principle of flying, so you didn't get yourself into trouble in terms of fog and high winds, frontal systems, and they discussed all of those and taught you the dangers and places to be and not to be as far as the weather was concerned.
Now, the radio or wireless, what training did you get on the wireless and Morse?
Bashing out 70 words a minute.
It was Morse training.
Yeah.
How did they do your Morse training? I mean, where?
Well, two. One was on a quay, and the other was in the park in Torquay, done on flags, like the Navy.
And how did you take to Morse?
Fair enough. We all had a system of being able to mouth our words of... We didn't quite understand what they were signalling. It was all right, and it wasn't too difficult, Morse.
What speed were they looking for you to get up to? About.
Do you know, I don't remember. I do think that if you were a wireless operator, they wanted 22 words a minute. Would that be a lot?
That would be quick, yeah.
Yeah, that would be quick. There were 20... If you went as a wireless operator... You were 22 words a minute. I think we were more like 8 to 10 words a minute.
What about wireless procedures and just general use of the wireless, the radio?
Yes, very much so. I mean, technically, a fair degree of depth about the radio and weather and navigation.
What was it? What about wireless procedure? What were they teaching you?
Well, how to pick up radio waves, because it was very much... very basic in those days, and use of RT, voice radio.
Were they already using the sort of set language that you always see here in these films? So Roger and over and out.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Was that actually already in place in 41?
Oh yes, absolutely. Except that the voice side was. In 1940, when I started, it was more harping on the technical side, bashing it out on the radio. But later on, the voice side, when UHF and VHF came along, of course, the voice started to take over much more. And all those expressions of Roger, in fact, well, I'm jumped the horses, go on.
Okay, so what other training did you have? We've gone through navigation, MET, Morse code, wireless. What other training? Theory of flight?
Yes, theory of flight, yes. I think so, yes. I think that was called airmanship. The airmanship included theory of flight and general handling of an aeroplane.
What, the theory of it?
Yeah, the theory of it. I don't think they went too deeply into the theory of flight. I mean... At that stage, this is basically an initial training wheel because in the form training there's more to come.
And what about, would you get a flight to sort of just see how you responded in an aircraft during your initial training?
No. The only thing nearest to an aeroplane was a Hawker Hart, which stood in the grounds of one of the hotels, and we used to jump in and out and twiddle the watch cord and the stick, and that was about as near to an aeroplane we ever got.
So, no, would that be all the training you did, or can you think of anything else you did?
A lot of marching, a lot of discipline. I think the marching, and squad competitions were... And there were big parades, and people used to turn out, the locals used to turn out to watch them. And we did all this fancy marching and reversing, and but no rifles. We just did it on foot, banging our feet, and made a lot of noise, and...
You didn't do any weapons training while you were there?
No, absolutely no, you know. Right, no, one thing was, pigeon, clay pigeon shooting. Clay pigeon shooting was set up because it was supposed to improve your eye as a fighter pilot. We all believed we were going to be fighter pilots. And we had a certain amount of time on the up at Babbock, I mean, that's where the range was. Clay pigeon shooting.
Was this with shotguns?
Yep, just as they do it now. But the idea, you had to learn deflection. And that was... And funny enough, it was done. The person who did it was Jennifer's uncle. And I didn't know it at the time, but I got to know him quite well after that. But he set the thing up. Because the whole of the initial training wing... was staffed by footballers, tennis players, or some well-known personalities from the stage. I mean, the man who ran it used to be a famous an Air Commodore, and I can't think, I'll think of his name in a moment. He was famous for his greyhound racing. No, it was a real setup.
Well, how did you get on with your instructors? I mean, you know.
Very well. No, very good. Oh, yeah, we had. Yes, very good. No, a very good relationship with them, I think. I mean, Jimmy Burns, I think it was Jimmy Burns, was a very well known professional golfer. And Ditchburn was, of course, well known because he had played for England. And now they were good, very good.
And they knew the stuff?
Oh, yes. I mean, Ditchburn's stuff was to keep us alert, make us smart, boots cleaned, you know, inspection of the bed, where they, some stupid little pilot officer would come in. We used to call them penguins, because they never, we knew they wanted to avoid the war. And they put on white gloves and go underneath your bed and say, look, Sergeant, put this man on Jankers for Saturday night. His bed's not clean. You'd have to have your biscuits into blankets into biscuits, and they had to be so many inches each. And the place had to be spotless, your boots had to be at the end of the bed, everything had to be spotless, and these wretched inspections. And this was, I think, probably to increase your sense of discipline.
I mean, how clean would they expect your boots, say, or your
oh, absolutely top, first, shining. And if you didn't, then you were into problems. Jankers. Saturday night. And always picked on Saturday night, because that was the night everybody used to go and spend their 1 and 6 or whatever it was. So we'd get 7 and 6 a week, I think. But beer was pretty cheap, and we only drank beer.
Would you go out in Torquay much?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, yes, we were swarming all over the place. Swarming with Air Force. All the pubs, because all the hotels were taken over, so there were no bars in the hotels. They took over all the hotels.
And what were the bars like, you know, that, you know, when this used to...
Oh, there were pubs and all Queens. There was sort of class distinction. They didn't like the Queen's Hotel, which was rather a nice hotel in Torquay. They didn't like us going in there because it was for the officers. But we discovered that some of us were brave and said, to hell, we don't mind your officer or not an officer. Where you have the right to go and drink in the Queen's Hotel. So, but basically, the pub drinking and a few bars, a few hotels where the bars were left, and not many of them.
But you were, it was beer by choice or beer by necessity. I mean, was it no
choice? My generation just wouldn't drink the hard stuff. I mean, it was too expensive. So I think it was by necessity, I don't know.
Did you drink much? I mean, you know, was it social drinking or
would
you
have
a one over the age?
Oh, no. You get clamped and put into a janker, then you've got a too drunk, or you're brought in drunk, you're into problems.
So it was just...
Oh, no, it was social, getting out and relaxing and chatting and meeting the boys and having a bit of fun. And there weren't many girls around because there were too many men. It was loaded. I mean, do you know Torquay? It's absolutely loaded with young 18, 19-year-olds wanting to go and fight and die.
How did you get on with your the other recruits? I mean, generally together. How did you find that everyone was from a similar background? Did you all meld in, or how did it go?
Well, that's a good point, really. That I think that it was quite obvious that the public school boys always finally migrated together, and the grammar school boys migrated together. But generally, I mean, you had to get on with each other. But socially, yes, I think it came out when associated. At night, you'd show the public school boys going out because they had some pubby in common. They played rugby at school together or something like that. Though this class barrier was around, I don't think it was very distinctive, especially in selection of training at the end. I mean,
would you know, you had your different groups, but would there be enmity between the different groups? Or
no.
Would it just be you chose
No, they're just generally... I discovered that much later on. Just generally, they're sort of like magnets thing, especially public school boys, they're dreadful.
So it wasn't so much that they were unfriendly to, say, the grammar school boys, it was just
by nature.
By choice.
By nature. That's how you communicated.
Were you assessed at all at the end of your time there? You were there until, well, till September, early September.
No, I don't think so. You weren't, I mean, as long as you passed your exams and passed your drills, well, no, that the next stage was waiting to be posted and to it flying.
Now, can I talk about this, what you wanted to do? You wanted to be a pilot, but you mentioned everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot. I suppose Hurricanes, Spitfires, the rest of it. Was that really the case, or did had you really worked it through in your head?
Oh, no, I think the thrill of flying. I hadn't certainly worked anything through my head. I think the thrill of flying was in Spitfires and aerobatics and very much indoctrination from the First World War, because it was very little, well, there were bombers in the First World War, but basically everybody knew and thought about fighters, and I think that all my pals, we all wanted to be fighter pilots, you know, so we didn't want to mess around with bombers or things like that. You want to get that up there, and, I mean, a Spitfire was a lovely aeroplane, and a Hurricane was a lovely aeroplane to fly, and
so that was everybody's aim?
I think so, yes. Oh, yes, because this came very much out of, you know, when you went to the next, you had to, at the end of this stage, we had to, what do you want to be, fighters, bombers, whatever. And it was quite obvious that everybody just fighter, first choice. But it didn't make much money difference, because they put you where they wanted in the end.
Oh, well, the second point was, at what point did your, I mean, you mentioned your father was with you before you came. How did your family react when they found out what you'd done? Because they did at some point.
Oh, yes, I had to get my mother and told her. I lied a bit and sort of said I was going into a, sort of a school outfit, which is for officer training, which it wasn't really. There was a unit for, the university were taking boys in, or young fellows, and giving them a year's training, which also was done in conjunction with the Air Force. And I used that as a sort of background, but then my father heard, he went for a walk. I remember where we walked in the Newlands Valley. He said, "You want to die?" So I said, "No, not necessarily." He said, "You come and work with me across the range there." And I said, "I'll arrange for you to go through the courts, and you're a good Christian, and you won't have to go to war." So I said, "Well, it's all too late, Father. I'm joined up now." And that's, I mean, our relationship was very remote anyhow. I mean, he talked in a different world about God and about, he was a chronologist. The chronologists always trying to discover the world, the movements of the world, and he foresaw the war, and he foresaw all sorts of things through his Bible reading and his studying. In fact, some of his work now is being used quite a lot. So he was a pretty formidable character, but basically, I wouldn't say too interested in us as kids.
But they didn't cut. He didn't cut you off when he found what you'd done.
Well, he had nothing to cut me off from. He had no money. He existed on my mother's money. And anyhow, I've been earning in the Forestry Commission. And my grandmother used to give me the odd sort of 10-bob note. 10-bob note in those days was a lot of money. A beer was only 4p or 6p, a half pint.
So you left in September 41. You left Torquay. And
right.
Your next posting was to number 24 EFTS.
Now, Elementary Flying Training School.
And tell me about
before
that.
We get to that, wanted to go to some went to America, some went to South Africa, some went to Canada, and some stayed at home. I wanted to stay at home. I don't know why I wanted to stay at home, because I thought I'd never see the war. And I didn't want to go and travel abroad, so I opted and got selected to do my training, Elementary Flying Training School at Luton, where now is Luton Airport.
And still as an aircraftman second?
No, LAC now. So LAC, the day we came to our flying LAC, and our pay went up to 7.6 a day, I think. It was quite a lot of money. It was enough money to come down to the Regent's Palace and stay a night in the Regent's Palace.
And what happened when you got to, where were you billeted at Luton?
Good point. I was billeted, I don't think it was Luton who. We were billeted in a magnificent house. where the owners were there, and he was a famous pianist. And we had to take our boots off. We weren't allowed in the house with our boots on. Everybody took their boots off and had to go and walk in their socks. Most lovely paneled and beautiful place. And I don't remember the name of it now.
But a comfortable billet.
Oh, it was a wonderful billet. And he was a very famous pianist, and some nights we used to get us all sitting up the staircase, and he used to play us Beethoven and Chopin, and it was great. It was amazing. And his sister had turned a hut in the garden into a cafe, so we could sit in there, have our beer and sandwiches and things.
How many were there at the
house? Well, I think a squad was probably 24, so there were probably 48.
Now, tell me about your training there. What take me through the stages of how they taught you to fly. I presume that's where you actually started. You're on the Tiger Moth, I think.
Yeah.
How did they start you? Or would you have a lot more ground lectures first?
We had ground lectures at Luton Airport, at Luton, and for about 2 weeks. And mainly on pilot navigation. And
is that
I'm talking about map reading and assessing maps and doing cross countries from A to B, and so you didn't get lost.
So this isn't so much the theoretical navigation of working out a course and then allowing for the weather. This is looking at a map and looking at what's below you.
Yeah. And also getting a weather report and getting some knowledge of the winds. So when you worked your map out, you could take... Because in actual fact, what you learned in those 2 years, what you were actually going to do in the 3 or 4 weeks ahead.
So first you did this, map reading and navigation, lectures or practical.
Yeah, and then to the airfield. Met by the flight commander and all his instructors. By which time we'd been kitted out too at Luton. We were kitted out.
Now what was your flying kit?
Yes, flying boots, a flying suit, which was.
Can you describe it to him? What the boots? What was special about the boots, if anything?
Well, I've got a pair if you want to see them. They were very much part of being a pilot. Battle of Britain boys had leather boots, but ours weren't, not leather, ours were cheaper stuff, because I think they'd run out of leather. But it was warmth, and they wanted, and there was sheepskin inside. So when you put your foot in, you know, it was pretty warm.
And the suits?
The suits, and also they give you, we had a sweater, I think, which we put on, and then the flying suit, which is one... suit, like a siren suit. It was one suit, and you pull the whole thing up and got inside it.
Was that lined?
Yes, and also a helmet. There was no radio. The only communication was by the instructor in front of you shouting at you.
So that was your flying kit.
So then we arrived at the airfield. Does it not say the airfield? There was some.
It doesn't. No, was it not at Luton then?
No, it was a satellite of Luton.